To everyone, both here in the courtroom and on WebEx, we will begin this morning. Introductions from the court. I'm Mike Havikin, the Chief Justice, and now by order of seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller Lerman.
Good morning. William Castle.
Stephanie Stacy. Good morning.
Jeff Funk.
Good morning.
Morning. Jonathan Pappick.
Good job, Friday.
Very good. And for those of you here in the courtroom, we appreciate it if you wear a mask when you are not presenting to the court, but when you are presenting, please take your mask off so that we can hear and understand what you have to say. And likewise, we will have our mask off so that you can hear and understand what we have to say. With that, Mr. Barber, you are on WebEx, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning to you. And Mr. Campbell, you are here in person, is that correct? Very good. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Barber. Then you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, and opposing counsel. My name is Joshua Barber, and I represent Cameron Williams in this case. Mr. Williams maintains that the district court incorrectly determined that his claim was barred by the intentional torts exception that's contained in the Nebraska State Tort Claims Act, which I will refer to as the Tort Claims Act in this argument, and that the district court incorrectly granted the state's motion to dismiss. He also contends that the district court incorrectly denied his motion for leave to amend his complaint after the district court determined that any amendment to that complaint would have been futile. Throughout the argument, well, Mr. Williams is asking this court to reverse the orders of the district court and remand the case back to the district court so that he can proceed with an amended complaint. I have laid out what those amendments would be in my reply brief, which was filed with this court. Throughout the argument, I'll refer to the appellees collectively as the state. Williams' claim against the state, both as pleaded in his complaint and as he has proposed in his reply brief, does not arise out of an assault. It is a claim for negligence. The claim is a tort claim allowed by the Tort Claims Act. It fits within the scope of the Act waiver of sovereign immunity because it's a claim for money on account of personal injury caused by the negligent acts and omissions of state employees acting in the scope of their employment. It is not a claim arising out of an assault, and it is not barred by the intentional torts exception.
I beg your pardon. This is Justice Miller Lerman. Could you be more precise and tell us what is the act of negligence or acts of negligence that you allege prior to any assault?
Thank you, Justice Miller Lerman. The act of negligence was an ongoing act of negligence, which was a failure to keep Mr. Williams separate from Jonathan Armendariz, who was another inmate in the custody of the Department of Correctional Services, who had, before going into custody, murdered Mr. Williams' brother. So what we allege is that Jonathan Armendariz and Mr. Williams were both listed on the department's central monitoring registry, and that according to department policy required that those two inmates be kept at separate institutions at all times. Armendariz, as Mr. Williams has alleged, was transferred into the same facility as Mr. Williams in the summer of 2017. Before that, he had not been at the same institution as Mr. Williams. Mr. Williams, and he was transferred to Tecumseh State Correctional Institution. So that's where they both were. And that's the first time that they were both at the same institution. It was sometime in the summer that Armendariz was transferred to, and all referred to the institution as TSCI. Sometime in the summer of 2017, he was transferred there. Mr. Williams became aware of that transfer. In other words, he became aware that Armendariz was at the same facility sometime in October of 2017. And that's alleged in the complaint. Shortly after he became aware of it, Mr. Williams began making requests to prison staff, unit staff, prison administration, and even communicated with his mother, who also reiterated those requests to prison administration to separate Mr. Williams and Mr. Armendariz, to transfer either Mr. Williams out of TSCI or to transfer Mr. Armendariz out of TSCI, because he was afraid for his safety because of the fact that Armendariz had previously killed his brother. And what we allege is that central monitoring policy, because of the way these two inmates had been listed as, I'm not sure if I'm using the right terminology, but keep separate inmates, they should never have been at the same institution. So Mr. Williams is terrified that some assault could happen at any time. If he comes into contact with Mr. Armendariz, he's afraid of essentially the same thing that happened to his brother happening to him.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you a question. If the actual physical assault had not occurred, are you claiming that there would still be a cause of action for negligence in all of the other facts that are presented in your complaint or as proposed in your amended complaint?
Yes.
And why?
Well, the harm that Mr. Williams suffered began occurring in October of 2017 when he learned that his brother's murderer was housed at the same facility where he was. We've alleged that the type of injury, the elements of damages, I should say more precisely, that we alleged in the complaint and proposed to refine in the amended complaint include emotional and mental harm, emotional distress.
Would that position take us to any time someone claims that they're mentally affected by a placement decision of the department, that they could have a cause of action?
I think they would have to be able to demonstrate that the level of mental or emotional distress that they incur rises to an actionable level.
Does Nebraska recognize
emotional
distress without physical harm?
I'm sorry?
Does Nebraska recognize intentional infliction of emotional distress without some physical harm?
Well, I think we would maintain that it would be negligent infliction of emotional distress. And I think we would suggest that there are physical elements that go along with the mental harm that is occurring. In other words, there are physiological manifestations that occur at the same time. And we maintain that in this case, that for example, if a person is terrified, if a person is caused extreme fear because of the zone of danger that they've been placed in, it manifests physically. And we maintain that that constitutes a physical injury sufficient to allow a cause of action. So to return to, I guess, the rest of my argument, in other words, Williams' claim, and I was getting to that point before Justice Castle asked the question of whether the claim would still have arisen if the assaults had never occurred. We maintain that it would have, because before the assaults occurred, Williams had already been badly mentally and emotionally injured for 7 months before anything happened. And what precipitated the initial assault was initially when Armendariz was placed at TSCI, he was placed in the special management. So he and Mr. Williams were initially on different housing units. After this period of him making requests to be transferred or to have Armendariz transferred, instead of and that is what precipitated an even fearful reaction from Mr. Williams, and he didn't have any other choice the way he saw it. I'm not saying I necessarily agree with that, but from his vantage point, he had no choice to protect him. And so he went after Mr. Armendariz, and eventually he was transferred over to the Nebraska State Penitentiary. And he alleges that the assault that occurred there occurred as a retaliation for what happened with Mr. Armendariz over at TSCI. So it was a long course of events. The negligence started, we maintain, in mid-2017 and continued on through September of 2018. And we would suggest, and I think the court's more recent opinions, even in Moser, the majority's opinions in the Moser case, as well as the more recent Edward case, that even if there is an assault somewhere in the chain of events, if it's attenuated enough from the negligence, the claim can still lie and not be barred by the intentional torts exception. We suggest that this is that case. And we would ask the
Mr.
court
Robert,
to-
I think your time has expired. So thank you very much. And we will proceed to Mr. Campbell. You may approach and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. James Campbell on behalf of the state appellees. I'd like to begin by addressing the district court's decision to grant the motion to dismiss. The court was correct to grant that motion because Mr. Williams's negligence claim falls squarely within the intentional tort exception. And I'd like to start by highlighting 4 points from this court's recent decision in Moser that I think apply directly here. The first is that the State Tort Claims Act intentional tort exception should be broadly construed. Second, it covers any case in which an assault or battery is essential to the claim. Third, it covers any case in which the injury arises out of assault or battery. And fourth and finally, it applies even if an inmate argues that negligence led to the assault or battery that caused the injury. I think if you take all those principles and you apply them in this case, it's a straightforward application of the intentional tort exception.
Mr. Barber just suggested that there will be instances where the assault is so far attenuated from the damages claimed, and apparently in this case it's emotional distress, that there is still a possibility to recover, even if there was an assault. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would say even if that were possible, that is clearly not this case. And the reason being that, first of all, in the original complaint, there was not an allegation for negligent infliction of emotional distress. There is a catch-all allegation that includes emotional damages, but it certainly didn't make the claim that there was extreme emotional distress that occurred before the series of assaults and batteries started. So I don't think that's this case. And even if we look at the new allegations that he wants to add to his complaint, which initially I would pause and say, I don't think that the court should consider these new allegations. They weren't presented to the district court, so the district court had no way to consider them. They weren't raised even until the reply brief on appeal. And so I don't think it's fair to fault the district court for not considering information that wasn't available to it. Two, this court generally doesn't consider facts and arguments raised for the first time in a reply brief. And third, this court has recognized that motions to amend should be denied when there's undue delay or unfair prejudice. And I think both of those arise if the court considers allegations that weren't raised until the reply brief. But having said that, even if the court considers those allegations, what Mr. Barber is attempting to allege on behalf of Mr. Williams is essentially a negligent infliction of emotional distress claim that was leading up to the series of assaults and batteries. More specifically, he claims that during the time period that I don't know how to pronounce his name, I've been pronouncing it Armendariz, but the gentleman who killed Mr. Williams's brother, he alleges that during the time he was in restrictive housing, that he had this severe emotional distress. But we would argue that there's a number of reasons that claim should fail. First and foremost, it does not rise to the level of severity that this court's case law requires for a negligent infliction of emotional distress claim. The court has been very clear that it must be distress so severe that no reasonable person could be expected to endure it. And what we're talking about here is a fear, supposedly, of facing physical violence from somebody who was in restrictive housing at the time. And the complaint repeatedly admits that during this relevant time period, Mr. Armendariz was in restrictive housing.
These deficiencies that you're arguing for, they would be tied to the intentional tort exception, though, right? That would be a reason that another possible claim would fail to state a claim. Did I have that right?
That's correct. That point about the deficiency in the level of severity of the harm, that doesn't go directly to the intentional.
Could you refresh my recollection about how, if at all, the court below was considered allowing an amendment?
So the court, I'm not sure if you're asking what the court below said or what the court below knew about a potential amendment. Either one. Okay. So start with what the court knew. The court was told two general things. First, that Mr. Williams wanted to include allegations to further establish the elements of negligence. We would argue that that's irrelevant because if the intentional tort exception applies, then the court never reaches the elements of negligence. So that doesn't help him. Secondly, Mr. Williams's attorney indicated that they would include allegations bolstering the court's jurisdiction. But the only clue that was given was at the hearing, and he indicated that he would like to add some facts to undermine the state's reliance on the discretionary function exception to the State Tort Claims Act, which was the state's alternative argument below. So again, those facts would not do anything to save Mr. Williams's claims because the intentional tort exception, not the discretionary function exception, applies. And so that was the information available to the court. And the court analyzed the motion to dismiss, and it found that the intentional tort exception applies. And then at the end of its opinion, it said that because the intentional tort exception applies, it would be futile to allow an amendment.
So this is an instance where the appellant's counsel had an opportunity to describe to the trial court what the possible amendment might be.
Not only was there an opportunity, but the district court specifically asked if a proposed amended complaint had been filed. And she was told that there was not. So then the judge asked if there was one that would be filed. And again, there was never a proposed amended complaint. And during the argument, there was some indications for what a proposed amended complaint might include, but there was never any detail. And that brings me to something that this court said just last year in the Cheney versus Ebden case. It involved the request to amend a complaint. And the court said that it will be very difficult for a plaintiff who doesn't lay out what they plan to say in an amended complaint to show that the district court abused its discretion. And the state would encourage the court to perhaps look at the Eighth Circuit precedent we cited and go even further, because the position that the district court was in here, I think, was manifestly unfair. The district court shouldn't be forced to guess whether there might be some facts out there that could salvage a plaintiff's claims. So what the Eighth Circuit has said is where a plaintiff fails to indicate the particular allegations that would make their claim viable, that the motion to amend should be denied. And I think that that would provide much greater clarity for the district courts and also for the state when we're defending a lot of these cases where a plaintiff comes in and seeks to amend the complaint. So it would be good to direct plaintiffs to give good indications for what they plan to say, which would aid not only the state as a defendant, but also the district courts. One of the other arguments that Mr. Williams makes in his brief is about the timing of the court's rulings on the motion to dismiss and the motion to amend. The court basically ruled on them simultaneously. He argues that the court should have ruled on the motion to amend first. I just wanted to highlight that he hasn't raised it today, but he did expressly waive that issue below. He was asked by the district court if he had any concern with her addressing the motion to dismiss first and then the motion to amend, and he specifically said that he didn't see a problem with that. To return to the point I was making earlier about the why these additional allegations, assuming the court's going to consider them, the ones asserted in the reply brief, why those don't state a viable claim over which the court would have jurisdiction. There's one other point. I mentioned the severity of the harm, and I also wanted to point the court to a case that was talked about in the Hamilton case that Mr. Williams cites in his reply brief. In the Hamilton case, it talks about Sell versus Mary Lanning Memorial Hospital. And that was a case where a woman was told by a hospital that her son was in a motorcycle accident and was deceased. And the next day she went and saw the body and found out that wasn't true. The court in Hamilton explained that that didn't rise to the level of severity to permit a negligent infliction of emotional distress claim. And I would say that if that doesn't rise to the level, then certainly a fear of another inmate who's in restrictive housing doesn't rise to that level either. The last point on
that.
What
about the fear after the inmate was removed from the restrictive housing and placed in the same cell block?
Your Honor, I think that's one of the more interesting things about the attempt to add these new allegations in the reply brief, is that he specifically alleges that this fear occurred and ended the day before Mr. Armendariz was released from restrictive housing. And so I'm not sure why he alleged it that way, but he says that this fear arose up until May 24th, 2018. And it wasn't until the following day, May 25th, 2018, that Mr. Armendariz was released from restrictive housing. And so I would say that that's not even encompassed within his allegations. But even if it were, it was such a short period of time. It was a matter of hours, perhaps days, when he was let out of restricted housing, again, at least according to the complaint, that I don't think that sort of a time gap isn't enough to allow a standalone claim that is separate and apart from the assaults and batteries. So that would be our position on that point. I see that my time's up. Unless the court has any further questions, we would just ask that the court affirm the lower court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't believe we have any time for rebuttal. Thank you very much. Mr. Barber, thank you for participating today by WebEx, and also Mr. Campbell, thank you. And counsel, you are excused. The court will go on to the Next case of the day, which is ICE versus ICE.